The great Australian novelist Thomas Keneally, winner of the Booker Prize for his 1982 non-fiction novel Schindler's Ark, has long cherished his Irish roots. His monumental work of non-fiction, The Great Shame, deals with the transportation of some of his own ancestors and highlights the achievements of the Young Ireland generation of Irish nationalists of the mid-19th century. In his latest novel, Fanatic Heart, he tells the story of the most controversial of those patriots, John Mitchell, a committed white supremacist and an apologist for the Confederacy during the American Civil War. I spoke to Thomas Keneally on the line from his home in Sydney, Australia, as part of the West Cork History Festival last August. That conversation ranged over Mitchell's life, his radical journalism, his transportation to Tasmania, and his escape to the USA, before focusing on his co-founding of the Irish Citizen newspaper in New York with Thomas Francis Marr, his feud with the abolitionist Henry Ward Beecher, and his increasingly racist journalistic output before his move from the North to the South in the 1850s. Keneally explains his view that Mitchell's opposition to capitalism informed his approach to the anti-slavery movement in the North, which included arch-capitalists he viewed as hypocrites for their own exploitation of labour. And just as an advisory in advance of this interview, it deals with the issue of slavery and of necessity includes some quotations incorporating the racist vocabulary of the 19th and early 20th centuries. Tom, you've written brilliantly in your book, The Great Shame, about this fascinating mid-19th century generation of Irish nationalists. So I'm curious, why choose now to write a fictionalised biography of the most controversial member of that group, John Mitchell, a man long since outed as a white supremacist, when you could have chosen any of the other members of that Young Ireland stroke Fenian cohort?
Yes, of course, John Mitchell, I was fascinated by the way he would propose to foreign governments that they invade England through Ireland and simply install him as president on the way through. But also this mysterious abomination he had of American capitalism. He saw the way the Irish were dying in boiler explosions in New York and in burning down of garment factories and so on. And he was appalled by the lack of engagement of capital in the question of compensating workers. And he came to believe that slavery was a much better system for looking after the individual. Of course, in those days, we had a number of racial theorists, including people who went into the reading of the head. I've got a weird head from North Cork, and I've got a criminal skull. And if you had a criminal skull, well, of course, you know, they transported a lot of Cork people, so of course we were good examples of the criminal skull. But also the belief that there were many strands of humanity. And there's always a debate, there's a very controversial debate about where the Irish themselves belonged in these strands. And Punch, as you know, had no inhibition about depicting you fellas as monkeys with muskets. Therefore, there were crazy race theories around at the time that help explain how he could make this diversion. And if you believe that the natural state of this lower order of humanity to which Africans belonged, and many tried to twin the Irish with the Africans, if you believed in that separate strain, well, there was more reason to believe that there might be a race who were suited to slavery. Now, we know that that is absolute human obscenity at this stage of history, but he had two of his boys die for that proposition. I have now written the second volume in which Mitchell's boys actually fight for the Confederacy one of them is killed at Gettysburg. John Mitchell, he never did things by halves, as you know, and he was a very radical and very doctrinaire socialist, and he got to slavery, defending slavery, through being appalled by capital, which is a very curious, to any position, to any place on earth, he always had his own peculiar way of taking the route.
He founds the Citizen newspaper with Thomas Francis Meagher in New York in 1854, and then becomes very quickly an apologist for slavery. I mean, one of his infamous lines in the Citizen is, and I quote here, "I, for my part, wish I had a good plantation well stocked with healthy Negroes in Alabama," unquote. Now, in the book, interestingly, you maintain that was intended as a joke. Is there actual written evidence of that, or is that surmise?
He was the sort of bloke who upped the ante, if given a chance. He wanted to become a defender of slavery because he hated the hypocrisy of American capital and the numbers of busted reservoirs and exploded factories that he saw Irish girls throwing themselves from the roof of rather than die of the flames. And I think that he was upping the ante, but I think at heart that was what he believed. He found, for example, a man whose reservoir of molasses exploded in Lower Manhattan, killed about 36 New Yorkers, some of whom drowned in molasses, which can't be a good way to go. He wrote about their unwillingness to identify with the workers, their willingness to depend on the next immigrant ship to fill the vacancies, which did indeed happen, and the fact that these people who had no sense of responsibility to their workers were sometimes, not always, were sometimes nominal abolitionists as well.
You devote a chapter to a discussion between Mitchell and the famous abolitionist, the Reverend Henry Ward Beecher, the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. The portrayal of Ward Beecher is less than complimentary. Before the discussion between the two men begins, you kind of depict him in advance as a vain and pompous philanderer. Now, even if that was the case, does it dilute Beecher's central argument that Mitchell was inconsistent in demanding freedom for Ireland on the one hand and continued enslavement of the African on the other?
Yes, indeed. And it was very much his character. He would declare one system flawed and therefore take the other system and defend it and stand by it.
In the book, you have Meagher, Thomas Francis Meagher, through the good offices of a Jesuit abolitionist, organising a meeting between Mitchell and two extremely articulate escaped slaves, a man called Jenkins and a woman called Atalanta Cunningham. Now, Mitchell is impressed by the testimony of these two escaped slaves, but not sufficiently to change his attitude towards slavery. And then later, in discussion with Thomas Francis Meagher, he compares the plight of the slave to that of the enlisted soldier. Now, I have to ask, is that a valid comparison? I mean, Meagher, in the book, certainly rejects it out of hand. He points out that soldiers volunteer, slaves don't.
Yes, that's right. Meagher was right, of course, as we know. I went to great trouble to try to show that I can understand where Mitchell got to, but it's not slavery as an obscenity. And he ignored the degree to which it was a system of sexual exploitation too. How women would become the mistress of the plantation owner. That evil of the plantation life, of sexual targeting, is something that he didn't seem to notice. Or he met with polite people. He knew men like Jefferson Davis, and he knew the vice president of the Confederacy, and they ran these slave plantations in which the housing was tolerable, the food was tolerable, the labour was tolerable, in which there were very rare floggings, and in which generally there was not sexual exploitation. But there was in places he didn't think there was. And so he looks upon the South as an unspoiled agricultural version of Ireland. And the slaves are better off than Irish peasants were during the famine.
Mitchell's opinion, obviously not yours.
Yes, and he betrays himself into this polarity between you've got to choose either capitalism or slavery. Well, I choose slavery.
You end your story well short of the Civil War when he moves from New York to Tennessee and brings the family with him, so that we don't see the more extreme journalism, the Civil War journalism of Mitchell. But I gather that there's another volume to come and that you'll be covering that part of his life in that volume, and you'll also be covering, for example, the death of his sons. A rather long final question, if you'll indulge me, because I want to ask you about your attitude to the legacy of John Mitchell. And let me give you a quote from Arthur Griffith in a preface to a new edition of Mitchell's Jail Journal. He wrote, again, I'm quoting here, "Even his views," that's Mitchell's views, "on Negro slavery have been deprecatingly excused, as if excuse were needed for an Irish nationalist declining to hold the Negro his peer in right. When the Irish nation needs explanation or apology for John Mitchell, the Irish nation will need its shroud." Now, that's one attitude, a rather exceptionalist Irish attitude to the legacy of John Mitchell, written by Arthur Griffith more than a century ago. An alternative viewpoint, widely held in Ireland today, is that the dozen or so GAA clubs which are called after him in this country should change their names, a la the Barclay Library in Trinity, and that his statue in Newry should be removed. So, what's your own position on the legacy of John Mitchell?
I think had he seen that both systems needed reform, if necessary, by revolution, but they both needed reform, that was the right decision. And I think he vitiated himself. I think his temperament was very extreme and he vitiated his inheritance. If he'd done a Maha and become a Union general, he would have been respected today because they happened to be on the right side. So I'm lenient, a bit more lenient on him in that when he meets Beecher Stowe's brother, he does use his character flaws as the basis for neglecting what he says. But I think what Beecher says, the Reverend Beecher says to Mitchell, is right from an imperfect human. And it's easy to depend on a man's imperfections to dismiss his argument. And I think, I mean, we can't. How can anyone stand up for a system like the jails, the slave jails in Richmond, which were run as private enterprises by friends of Mitchell's in the South, in Richmond itself, in the old tobacco drying areas of Richmond? And how can you defend selling young women of lighter skin for more than running their price up? How can you stand in favour of hunting them down and of finding, as the Dred Scott decision is, that they should be returned to the South and that Northern citizens have a duty to send them back to the South? No, I can't. He was wrong because of his extremism led him to be extreme in this one issue. And when I say he went all the way, he wanted to restart. He wanted slavery to be more democratic in this sense. He wanted to reopen importation from Africa itself, from West Africa, so that the price of slaves would go down and poor whites in the South could buy them. So no one need go without. So that was the most extreme wing of the pro-Southern slavery opinion, and he belonged to it.
Basically, by the end of the Civil War, he thought Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee were both wimps, didn't he?
Oh, yes, he was in favour of a much more strenuous brutalisation of the North by the Southern Army whenever it crossed the border. And as well as that, it was always possible to look at the American soldiers and say they want to free the slaves, but they don't want them to live in the same town. They want them to be recolonized in Africa. And there was a lot of this, even Lincoln sent a general, General Sickles, who lost his leg at Gettysburg, sent him to Colombia to ask the Colombians to take American slaves. And so I find there's great hypocrisy in America about slavery still, in that there are people who are trying to cut out aids to less literate African-American voters in Texas as we speak. They don't want there to be special help for African-Americans who might not be fully literate because of the education system, the inequalities of the education system, who don't want them to have help in the election booth. So this is a form of slavery still in my book, and they've been very good at standing against the principle of slavery, as they should have, but not at making the African Americans integral to society. That is a process that's on its way. It's a process that's happening, but it's a very incomplete process as yet. But he did, John Mitchell, destroying his human heritage, which he gained in the famine by imagining what it was to be a famine-struck Irish person. He did betray that by his enthusiasm for the South. And part of his enthusiasm was contrarian, was pure contrarian nature of the kind that some unionists have in the North and certainly some Republicans have. God, I'm digging a grave for myself next time I come back to Cork. But I hope the second book will be out next year with Faber and Faber. And really, it's full of events and sex and drugs and rock and roll. And I've made it sound like a constitutional argument. But
well, we'll look forward to that second volume. The current book is called Fanatic Heart. My guest is Thomas Keneally, and my thanks to the West Cork History Festival for facilitating that conversation.